Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
The Science of Sports Podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
Tell me, you know, my testosterone, you know, being born, you know, without the uterus, you know, being born with internal testicles, those don't make me less a woman. It's just the differences that I was born with, and I embrace them.
So that is the voice of Caster Semenya, and that was an interview that she did with the BBC after the release of her book, The Race to Be Myself, a memoir by Caster Semenya. And a controversial statement, I'm sure there's a lot of people who have commented on that. In fact, there has been a lot of social media around that particular comment, and lots of social media around lots of other bits and pieces and interviews that have been done over the last couple of weeks, both here in South Africa and around the world, around the Caster Semenya issue and this book in particular. And some quite revealing stuff in the book itself. And we'll talk a little bit about that and other things in this episode. We're going to touch a little bit on some of the interesting doping cases that are happening as well. The World Marathon record, which happened a couple of weeks ago. And we'll touch on some of the news after all the excitement of the Rugby World Cup that we've been dealing with over the last couple of months. But Professor Ross Tucker, of course, here with me as usual. And that comment by Caster Semenya kind of highlights the very issue that has been in uppermost mind of everybody around Caster Semenya. I watched an interview here in South Africa where she talks in detail about the tests that were conducted on her by officials during her most traumatic period of her life, or literally inserting probes into various parts of her body trying to decide. But this kind of highlights, I wonder whether it highlights her belief that she is a woman, and but the testicles are not necessarily an issue. I mean, it's a complicated one, because it's I'm not sure whether she wants people to believe that or whether she believes it herself.
She has to believe it, right? Because the whole premise of her career depends on that belief. So I think that's the first point I'd make. She's probably said 4 or 5 things that have made headlines in the last 2 weeks in promotion of the book. And there are two parts to them. One is the biological reality, which I don't think she represents accurately. That statement that we've just played in there is the fundamental thing. In the context of sport, those testes make a big difference because they are the things that produce testosterone, and testosterone is the hormone that is primarily and largely responsible for the reason that we have to have a women's category that is exclusive for people who don't have male testosterone and male biological advantage. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So when she says that, when she says other things, and we'll get on to maybe a couple of those, she's saying what is necessary in order for her story to remain intact, the validity of her career, her athletic career, to remain intact. So when an interviewer says to Caster Semenya, do you have an unfair advantage? She cannot say yes. When an interviewer says to her, should the athletes who finished 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th in the Olympic Games in 2016 feel unhappy? She cannot say that they were cheated out of medals.
Yeah.
Because it would in effect be an admission. And so some of the reaction on social media, I'm not surprised by, but I would say people think about it. Like, what else is she going to say? In fact, if you're an interviewer asking that question, do you really expect her to say, absolutely, those women should feel really unhappy because I had an unfair advantage, shouldn't have been in the race? Do you really expect that? So obviously she's coming out and saying something in defense of her own identity and her career, not gender identity, her athletic identity, right? So we'll get onto some of the physiology of it, because I think it needs to be corrected, because I have read easily a dozen reviews of that book, and literally one of them, which was written by Janice Turner in the Times, is the only one that has called out the biological fallacy that Semenya is not a woman with high testosterone, but in fact has a difference of sex development that affects males. And so in fact, what we're talking about here is male with normal testosterone, but competing in women's sport.
Yeah. Excuse me. And that's an important differentiator to make there, because I think there's always
the differentiator.
It is, but I've always been under the perception that before this podcast, in fact, to some extent, that she is closer to being female than she is to being male. But actually, what you're saying is she is essentially male in every respect.
In the context of sport, that's exactly what it is, and that's why the CAS decision went the way that it did, is because World Athletics was able to finally make that case. That wasn't always the case, and I think your perception is one that's shared by many in the media, who I do think should by this stage know better. If I'm interviewing Semenya now on BBC and I'm doing the story, like, I would at least think I'm going to understand why there's controversy here. Yeah. And it's not controversial because you're dealing with someone with high testosterone. You're actually dealing with someone who is, by argument, in the wrong category, competing in a category they should be ineligible for because they have male biological advantage. So just to try and
piece... It's not just the testosterone, is it?
Exactly. So what... And if you read the CAS decision, it's all in there, right? They even name the specific condition because there's a number of these differences of sex development. The one that has been most prominent in sport is called 5-ARD, 5-alpha reductase deficiency. So... 5-alpha reductase is an enzyme that we all have in our bodies, except when you have this difference of sex development. And its job is to convert testosterone into another hormone called DHT. If you don't have it because of the deficiency, you can't make DHT. So what does DHT do? DHT is the hormone that is primarily responsible for the creation, if we're going to call it that, or the differentiation of male genitalia. So what's happening in these individuals is that they are XY chromosomally. They have the male Y chromosome. Therefore, in utero, there is a signal carried by that chromosome so that those gonads become testes. That's what Semenya is talking about, my internal testicles. That's literally like your XY with testes. Testes that produce normal levels of testosterone. Testosterone that can do its job in your body, which is to say male development, with that one exception. And that one exception applies to the genitalia. And so biologically, for the purposes of sport, the person is male advantaged fully. The only thing they don't have is the male genitalia that allows the identification of sex at birth. You know, sometimes some people call it assigned at birth. It's identified. The doctor says it's a boy or it's a girl, sometimes before birth. But they don't always have that because you're born effectively with ambiguous genitalia. And so then the doctor might often say it's a girl. But then at puberty, things start to look different because there's still testosterone. And that testosterone still does its job as it would in a male because, well, not as it would in a male, as it does in a male.
So going back, I mean, we've done this in past podcasts where we look back into how they used to identify male females back in the 70s and 80s. It's just a case of like, take your pants off and let's see what genitalia you have. But it's not simple as that.
Yeah, and it needn't be as crude as that. And if it's as crude as that, there's a risk that you'll run into problems because it's not as straightforward. Because in this specific condition, the difference is the genitalia don't appear typically male. In fact, might more often lean towards appearing typically female because the signals that make male genitalia, internal and external, are not there because of this deficiency of an enzyme. That would make sense, right?
Yeah.
So effectively, you break the pathway, the communication pathway. So you've got all the testosterone in the world, but you can't do that one thing with it. But everything else you can do. And that was fundamental at CAS, is the CAS experts were arguing against Semenya's experts that this deficiency of this one enzyme and therefore this one hormone is not material to sport. Semenya's team had to argue that it was. But I'll tell you, the reason I think it's interesting is in 2016, I think it was, when they first went to court about these conditions, it wasn't Semenya, it was an Indian athlete called Duti Chand. The policy then was called the high androgenism, so that's male hormone policy. And the whole argument then was women with high testosterone. And that's the position I think that you're still, you were talking about earlier. It's like you've thought of Semenya as a woman with high testosterone. All the media, the BBC, that clip comes from, same story. They all frame it as this is a woman in women's sport with high testosterone. Natural advantage, yes or no. And what changed in the Semenya case, and I distinctly remember receiving these documents because, for disclosure, I was one of the expert witnesses. And we got these documents, and for the first time, World Athletics had come at it from the other perspective and said, this is not about women with high testosterone. We're not interested in someone who's XX with ovaries, not testes, and who has high levels of testosterone. We're interested in individuals who are XY, who have testes, who have male testosterone, and who can use it. So those were the four things. And it was, I guess in a way, like especially in hindsight, obvious shift. But it was the most important shift, because all of a sudden it became less about natural advantage, excluding some women, not others, and saying, actually, this is fundamentally about who belongs in women's sport. Is it females or males? And they finally, I mean, their argument in advance of the Semenya hearing was really good. And that's the reason they won it.
I guess what becomes confusing is that when World Athletics were directing that athletes like Semenya were able to, if they were able to reduce their testosterone levels, they'd then be able to compete at certain events. And so that creates the idea that, okay, it's just about too much testosterone, because once that goes down, we're going to let you compete in events. So that's where the confusion comes in. Yeah. And in fact, that's not accurate, because you can't change your chromosomal makeup.
No, and it's actually...
The testosterone is almost insignificant in that respect, in fact.
Yeah, so it's an interesting one, and it's the same... It's the same mistake, I'll call it that the authorities have made when they're trying to regulate trans women in women's sports, because they did the same thing. And you can understand the logic, as they're saying, right, the reason that we have to have a policy at all is because of male performance advantage. Why does male performance advantage exist? Testosterone. So therefore, the root cause is the testosterone. If we take the testosterone away, problem solved. We can include and be fair all at the same time. And the problem is that A, you can't, because even when you take away testosterone, its effects persist beyond it.
Yeah, for sure.
Like there's a legacy effect and you can call it an asymmetry. Once it's done its work, you can't undo its work. You can take some of it away, not others. We've discussed this in the context of trans. But I think in this particular instance, it created a red herring, because as you say, people got preoccupied with it. It's all about the testosterone. It's actually not. It's all about male advantage. Mm. And testosterone is simply the messenger that carries and creates that male advantage. Mm. But it's actually male advantage. That's the issue here is you're not, you know, and you can see that there's a fundamental difference, I think, between saying here is a female with high testosterone, polycystic ovary syndrome, for example, as opposed to here's a male with typical testosterone. How you evaluate those two cases is really different. And one of the ways that it actually plays out, and this is one of the other things that Semenya said in the week in that same interview, is, do you have unfair advantage? She said, no, and of course I don't. If I had male advantage, why am I not running male times?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is actually really interesting, because this also came up in the CAS decision, in the hearing, because they made the same play. And it's, excuse me, I've got a bit of a scratchy throat from travel, so I apologize for coughing. The argument is that if I have male advantage, I should be running male times, and I'm not. I'm running 153, 154. The men are running 142, 143. Well, no. Just because you have male advantage doesn't mean you're running male times. I mean, I'm not running sub 2.
Yeah.
You're not running sub 2. Yeah. 99.9% of men are not running sub 2.
Yeah.
The 0.001 who go to the Olympics are running 144, 145. But it's obvious that you're not going to, just because you have biological advantage of male doesn't equal performance. So it's another one of those where for so many to argue that is ludicrous, but she has to. You know what I mean? It's a necessary defense that she has to make.
But she's opening herself up for quite rough criticism in that respect, because it is a ludicrous comment to make.
So you know what, though? They made that case in the CAS hearings. You know what the World Athletics response was?
Mm-hmm.
How would you respond?
I don't know how you'd respond to that, because it's not based on any fact.
This was the most telling single thing in the World Athletics response, is they said, we know that athletes with 5-IRD have not yet run male times, but that's just because they're relatively mediocre males. And they called it, eh? They literally said that. So in point 289 of the CAS decision, I'm reading this to you verbatim. While no 5-IRD athlete has yet won a women's event by a margin of 10 to 12%, this fact has nothing to do with their condition. Rather, it reflects the fact that the particular athletes we have seen thus far are not as good as the best males. Like many other non-elite males, they still beat the very best biological females just by a smaller margin. So that, to their credit, World Athletics got this pitch and they batted it away. And they said, we know you're not running male times, but that's just because you're not that good.
Yeah.
And you know what, I think they learned was Pistorius made the same argument and they didn't respond that way. Back in 2008, I forget when it was. Pistorius was, remember...
This is Oscar Pistorius, of course.
This wasn't his latter infamous trial. This was his trial about, do I have unfair advantage because of my blades? And he said, if I had an unfair advantage, I'd be breaking the world record. I'd be running 41 seconds, not 45. World Athletics should have said then, no, but that's just because you're a mediocre athlete with good advantages. And they didn't do it then. And I think they learned. And eventually they had the conviction to get on the front foot and say, no, it's because you, like other AOD athletes, you're just not an elite male.
No.
And that's why you're running world-class women's times like the 16-year-old kid in Stellenbosch who's in the program I'm running. You know what I mean? He ran a 152 this year. So she has teed herself up for that. But again, she has to say it. Because to not say it would be to undermine the book and her life's athletics achievements. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like I see all the criticism of her and I get it. But it's also you're watching a production now. Everyone's on a script a little bit.
To some extent, she's trying to promote a book, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And defend. And the promotion of the book is in defense of her life story. So she sort of has to do it. So I would be a little more sympathetic. The one I'm not sympathetic to is they ask her about Lindsay Sharp, who was, I think, sixth in Rio. Definitely top six. Might have been, I forget exactly. And she gives a tearful interview to the BBC or one of the British media about saying how unfair it is and so on. Now, she's right. Because she is in the correct category, having to race against people who are not. It's the same as a middleweight boxer who finds himself having to fight heavyweights. You'd say this is not fair. So she's legitimately, I think, saying that. So Menya's asked about it, and she says, yeah, Lindsay's a good runner. If she'd shut up and trained harder, maybe she'd have won a medal. Now, that's not going to win you any sympathy when you know the facts. And so she's made herself out there to be quite contemptuous of other people in denial of the facts, which has been the least pleasant. Everything else I understand, but I don't know. There was a way to navigate that maybe that she didn't take.
I mean, potentially one of the most controversial parts, and you've touched on it very briefly there, is in the book, which you show me the picture, there's a picture of her as a 15-year-old at the beach, basically dressed in literally just a pair of shorts and clearly representing herself as a male in that situation. She's not dressed female. Now, one of the things that we've always heard from her is that she lived and she grew up as a female. She's brought up as female. She's always identified as being female. That picture tells a different story to that because she's certainly not dressing herself as a female in that situation. Yeah. And the book gives more detail, and she has done this many times. She's talked a lot about her upbringing. She wasn't doing a lot of female tasks. She was doing a lot of male tasks. So I suppose it raises the question, how much did she know about her own condition and how was she being... Yeah. Deliberately honest about her decision or about her place.
It does. And the more you learn about it, the more you have to ask that question. But I won't cop out of it, but I will say I don't really care initially. Like, it almost doesn't matter to me. Like, and it's the same even with her argument about my testicles don't make me any less of a woman. Like, I would argue biologically they very much do. But in terms of a gender construct and in terms of social roles, and again, maybe this is foreign for some people listening overseas, but like in places where Caster Semenya grew up, there are still very, very firm boundaries, would you call it,
around patriarchal society.
It's very patriarchal. There are women's roles, there are men's roles. I'm all for breaking those. Like, those gender type roles, stereotypes, like, they don't matter to me when I watch an Olympic Games. Like, whether you were had the girls' role in your village or the boy, like, I'm watching you run an 800. It's almost immaterial. And similarly, I don't know whether there was a point in Semenya's development from the age of 10, 11, 12 into puberty and adolescence where suddenly she's like, I don't know. I genuinely don't know. But it almost doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is, do you have male biological advantage in the sporting context? Yes or no? Yes. So therefore, everything else flows from that. As to the question, I saw that picture as well, and I genuinely don't know. She studied sports science. She sat in, to her credit, in every minute of the Cass hearing. So every argument that we've just discussed and 100 others, she's listened to and heard. I presume she's read many of the documents. She knows the concepts behind this. She knows what ARD is. She knows all these things. But she's entitled to her own belief about identity. But that doesn't mean that you can just set aside the biological facts. You know, like, is that a cop out? I mean, you can't read her mind. I will say the following: is this ARD? About half of all cases that are identified as girls at birth. That bit I believe for Semenya. And then as they reach maturity and they get to puberty, they recognize that that was wrong. And so about half of them identify as boys once they reach adolescence. And so it's known as different things. In one country, it's called Turney Man Syndrome because they literally recognize it as turns into a man. This was, we identified you as a girl, we raised you as a girl, but now you're a man. And that's how they call it, literally by what happens in the process. I don't know where this changed for Semenya. She talks in the book about like going to the girls' bathroom and being chased out by the girls. I don't know whether Annika Larson's a journalist interviewed her. She talks about questions that were asked about her from her very first days of competing. Ah, that's a boy running in the girls' race. So clearly she's known the perception. She now knows the facts and theories. She can't acknowledge them, obviously, because she's chosen something different. But again, for me, it's like biological, you know? And it's a bit, which then brings up the other part of it is there's that element to it. And then there is, and this is the bit that I think, again, a lot of people don't gloss over, but they don't treat with what I think is the necessary. These things are hell of a difficulty. Like, I know someone who recently had to deal with a situation like this in sport, going to someone who was playing a girls' sport and was identified for health reasons as needing some testing and screening, and that screening revealed one of these conditions. Incredibly tricky to deal with. Because you're going to someone who has, and again, who knows about Semenya, but this in this particular case, has never thought of themselves differently as a woman. And then suddenly, imagine that bombshell. No, you're not you.
Yeah.
And this person was sensitive about it and said, like, it's the most difficult thing, most difficult conversation I've ever had to have. We've had to give this person psychological counseling support. We've had to give them medical support because there's all sorts of medical things that need to go along with it. These things are really tricky. And maybe in the Western world, like if you're in the States or Europe or something, you don't encounter this because they get picked up before birth.
Yeah.
Here in South Africa, this stuff's happening.
Yeah.
It's not picked up. And then you're 16, you pick it up. It's very difficult.
Yeah. And as you've said on many different occasions, there's in every scenario, nobody wins in this situation.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's tragic in every way.
Exactly. And I'll tell you how you lose is the way that the sports have handled these athletes. And Semenya's not even the worst of them. Like she tells in the book about the – because the invasiveness is of the ultrasound because what you're looking for is those internal testes.
Yeah, she talks so in detail
this,
about
– you got to get this ultrasound wand into the body now. Like it's not – that's no fun, eh?
No.
I mean, but she's by no means the worst. There's a paper that came out describing case series in sport where they then heard testimony. Literally, they'd fly these athletes to a hospital in the south of France, put them up for a couple of nights, hotel, take them in for testing and treatment, surgical removal of those internal testes without getting consent, without disclosing to the athletes. Like just awful stuff that was done in the name of defending the category.
Yeah.
And like I think that stuff's indefensible. You have to defend the women's category. You can't just say, I'll carry on as you were identified. Like you'd have to have a boundary that you defend. But I do think the way that it's been handled in the past has been really awful. So I think those two things can coexist. And so many has had to endure in public what no one should. And so when she's angry, like, yeah, of course, you would be too. And I would ask people to be like a little more understanding about that side of things.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we can't just set aside biological reality because someone wants us to. So it's a very tricky one. Like But for the sake of women's sport, you have to say, this is not a question of females with elevated testosterone.
Yeah. And it's and I think that's one of the lessons I've sort of taken out of this is because, like I've said, and much of the media says, there's this misconception because of what's happened at Wood Athletics level and about the focus on testosterone. So it's an understanding of the condition, which is important. So
And the media's not picked that up. Like, the media are reporting this policy as if it's 2016. It's as if time stopped. And they haven't recognized, you know, if the IAAF World Athletics had never changed the paradigm away from women with hyperandrogenism to males in female sport, that thing about why am I not running male times becomes actually quite hard to defend.
Yeah.
Becomes quite a philosophical question about the degree to which I get the advantage. Maybe there's a sort of intermediate position. But the moment they changed their position, all those things kind of fell into place. And somehow the media just haven't recognized it. Partly because they don't work hard enough to read the cast decisions, and partly because
it's also difficult to explain.
It can be.
It's a very difficult thing to explain in a news story. That's one of the challenges, I think, for me. How do you explain that to the average person out there about what DSDs are and how it relates? And because, of course, everybody asks the most basic questions. And those of you that listen to this podcast probably have better information. But the average person out there, to understand the condition is tricky. And difficult to write.
and that's why, credit to someone like Sean Ingle, because Sean Ingle won't write an article about it without saying Semenya was born with XY chromosome and a condition that caused da da da. You know, so like, okay, it's there. And that's a statement of fact, and how you use that fact is very much up to you. You know, like so there will be people who say, not her choice. She was let her compete. Okay, but as long as you do that honestly, recognizing that by letting Semenya compete, you are allowing male advantage into women's sport. If you're happy with that, carry on.
Yeah.
But sport cannot be happy with that. It shouldn't be. And so it should work, I think, harder to reject arguments like, in this context of sport, my testicles don't make me any less of a woman. That's kind of the whole point. They do.
Unfortunately, they do.
And you are more than welcome to live your life in the identity you please, but this actually has consequences for females who have rights too. So that's the problem. So I don't think, it'd be interesting to know, because I'm very aware that in Twitter now I'm seeing people who, I've been blocked by all that. So it's an echo chamber now. Has the book been well received? Because it's certainly
it's creating news stories.
Her promotion of the book has not been well received at all. I've seen a lot of people saying, I was quite sympathetic, but this contempt she shows for Lindsay Sharp, the way that she's but I don't think that's probably representative of the truth. And so one last point is, you know, she won the UN Human Rights Court. That's now being appealed, the human rights claim. The UN, I think it was a 4-3 split, said that her human rights had been violated, not by the policy, which is why it won't change. I mean, it couldn't anyway.
This is the policy of World Athletics.
Yeah, not by the policy per se, but by the implementation of the policy. She didn't have the right to reasonable appeal and so on. So the Swiss courts have now said they'll appeal that. So even the legal side of this thing is going to be dragged on and on and on for a little while longer.
Just as a final point, just to update us, is she still in a position where if she lowered her testosterone, she'd be able to compete in female events?
Yeah,
she can still do that.
It's a little bit different. She has the choice. The policy is a little bit different from the policy that she appealed against in 2019. Back then, memory serves me, it was 6 months below 5.
Yeah.
So you know, the female range is up to the 99th percentile is 3. So in fact, the average is 1 point something, and 99% of women are below 3. Men's range is normally considered to be 10 and up. World Athletics said 5. You had to lower your testosterone to 5 or lower for 6 months. In May this year, they changed it to 2.5 for 12 months.
Wow.
So, for example, the Namibian athlete Mboma, who won silver in Tokyo, is now eligible to compete because that 12-month period has elapsed. I saw an interview with her and her coach recently saying she's very much looking forward to the next Olympics. She wants to go to Paris and win another medal. She's running exactly the same times, even though she's lowered her testosterone. So that's going to be quite interesting to watch. Because
that touches on the chance issue, the fact that there's still male advantage in terms of her structure and musculoskeletal.
Yeah, and one of the evidence, pieces of evidence that World Athletics introduced in the Semenya case was a series of 3 or 4 athletes. I forget exactly. It was Berman et al. I'll find it and pop it in the show notes. in which they documented the effect of lowering testosterone on performance in these DSD cases, and they showed about 5.6% loss of performance in these 800. Mm. And that was about right for Semenya, because she was running like 155s, and then she slowed down to about a 159, 2 minutes for a season or two. And then when she was allowed back in without suppression, she went back to 154s. There were a couple of others as well in that case series. So they were showing 5% loss. Remember, the male-female gap's 10 to 12. Mm. So that implies you can take some male advantage away, but not all. Mm. So now with Mboma, who's running in the 200, she was a 22-second athlete. If she's running 22 next year, she hasn't slowed down at all.
Yeah.
Despite the suppression of testosterone, which actually...
I mean, it gets very messy, because essentially you could get a male coming in there and reducing his testosterone and saying, I can compete in female events.
Remember, this is where it is really messy, is that World Athletics, at the same time that they announced that policy, they announced their trans policy, which says no males in women's sport.
Yeah.
So remember, World Athletics excludes trans women from women's events, but they don't exclude DSD males from women's events. Mm. And why would that be? Because biologically, they are the same. The only difference is legally. One was identified as a girl at birth, and the other one is identifying themselves after birth as being a woman. You know,
there is some control there.
Yes, certainly over a male identifying as a woman and then saying, I'm now going to run in the women's events. Athletics, swimming, rugby, as we know, cycling now, also this year, have all appropriately, in my opinion, protected women's sport by excluding males. But it's interesting, Athletics has almost compromised that for the DSD athletes, I think, in part, as like a hat tip to the ethical, legal complexity of the case. Mm. You know, like they've sort of, it's almost like we are sympathetic towards these rare events, and so we're going to allow these males to compete with low testosterone, but not those ones, even though biologically they are the same. And that's why... If Mboma does this and she runs 21.6s, 21.7s, okay, she'll have to run faster to beat Sherika Jackson maybe. But it'll be interesting, because it'll be, again, more evidence that taking away the testosterone doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah.
So keep an eye on that one. But Semenya's 32. She could run. She's just said she's never going to take the poison. She calls it poison in the... In the book, and she describes, and she's not the only one who's described pretty nasty side effects of having to lower your testosterone that much, right? Because I mean, you're dealing with people who've got testosterone in the 20s now down to nothing.
Yeah, it's going to have an effect.
It is a biological shock.
Yeah,
different from a woman taking a contraceptive pill. Mm. You know, this is a bit different. So, it's not, and even here, ethically, maybe this is the last word. Is if the treatment doesn't take away the advantage, then what's the point of taking it? All you're doing is creating like side effects and potential harm. That's why sport, I don't think, can justify a testosterone reduction strategy. It doesn't work and it's unethical.
But then what is the solution?
Males in male sport, females in female sport. Mm. Same as they've done for trans.
Then you're down to what defines male, female, et cetera, et cetera.
A little bit in that sense.
Does it come down to just chromosomes then?
For me, biology, it's exactly what it is. You know?
So if you're a Y chromosome, you're male.
Unless you're completely incapable of using the testosterone because you have androgen insensitivity syndrome. But that's not an ARD.
Yes, it is it's a complicated story, isn't it? Gee whiz.
Sort of, it is. Yeah. And
because potentially there's always going to be athletes like this throughout history. I mean, they will continue to be.
1930s was the first one. Stella Walsh was the famous one. And again, in the retelling of these, they might get lost a little bit. But the story with Stella Walsh was won all these medals, Polish, then settled, I think, in Ohio, gets killed in a bank robbery. Because of that, it's an autopsy, mandatory autopsy, discovers ambiguous genitalia. Oh, everyone says this was a man competing in women's sport. Into the 1950s, there were a whole bunch of athletes from the Eastern Bloc countries who were accused of men. They were accused as men masquerading in women's sports. A lot of them probably were what was that back then called intersex, but actually it's these DSD conditions. Mm. There's a story of a cross-country skier called Eric Schinniger, same condition as Semenya, discovers, wins Olympic medals in downhill skiing, discovers the condition, actually changes to, sorry, Erika Schinniger, was competing in women, discovers this issue, changes to Eric Schinniger, gave the medals back, said it's not fair that I won these medals in women's skiing. I was never a woman.
Wow.
So it has happened in sports.
Sure.
Where actually the person has come out and said the anti-Semenya life story. So that, you can look all these things up and read about them. So yeah, it's happened, and it's happened when we did the Semenya case, like South America, Middle East, Eastern Europe, Southern Sub-Saharan Africa. That's where these conditions are now. They used to be very prevalent in the Eastern European countries.
Mm. So the book is out, The Race to Be Myself, a memoir by Caster Semenya. If it's something that really interests you, you want to delve into the depths of it, it's worth looking at it and looking at it with a critical eye, I guess, based on what we've been talking about. But it certainly gives you a lot of insight and some quite graphic details about her life, a very tragic life in many ways. Anyway, let's move on to something else. And last week we touched a little bit about the whole idea of carbohydrates and the overuse of carbohydrates, and how a lot of the top teams were claiming that they were super carbohydrating when they were doing rides. And one of the things we talked about was the fact that you could actually, your body would respond to carbohydrates and the glucose, fructose, if you just use a mouthwash. In other words, if you put some of that stuff in your mouth, your body will then respond. Simon from Sydney, one of our patrons, then contacted us and said, well, actually, he found a paper that was titled, and I'll read it to you very quickly if my phone will open quickly, Understanding the Oral Mucosal Absorption and Resulting Clinical Pharmacokinetics of Aspirin, which basically talks about the fact that there is absorption through the mouth, and it isn't just a placebo effect, and that in fact there are drugs that do get absorbed through the mouth. Therefore, he was questioning whether we were accurate in that. I guess the first question is, maybe there is some absorption, but how much
is there? Well, my first question is, what's a senapine? Because you sent me that link, and I said, geez, what is that? Is that like, turns out it's a drug used to treat schizophrenia.
Right.
So I'm not immediately sure that its absorption is the same as sugars.
Yes.
So, okay. But I guess the point he's trying to make is that you can absorb stuff in the mouth. Mm. Fine. That's fine. Like, and as we said, like last week, inside this gut is still outside the body.
Mm.
It's got to get in somehow. Mm. And it's definitely plausible that some uptake can happen in the mouth. But think about the volume.
Mm.
If you use like a mouth rinse method, where it's just a sort of sip and then you spit it out.
Yes. Because there is evidence, as we discussed last week, of somebody.
Yeah, and it's not one of those one study, never redone. Like there were a dozen or so, and I provided a link last week, where out of the dozen studies, like 9 have found a meaningful effect on performance. But think about the volume. I mean, what volume can possibly be absorbed in the mouth when you spit it out anyway?
Correct.
It's like a tiny volume. I mean, it must be teaspoons worth.
Well, he was commenting that his girlfriend says that when she's doing endurance events, that she basically sucks a sweet for the whole time. The absorption, the constant absorption of some sort of carbohydrate through the mouth, actually she feels makes a difference.
It might make a difference, but it's making a difference by acting on some central nervous system process, not fuel utilization in the muscle. Because
so even continually sucking a sweet's going to not
Because what's the volume of a sweet? I mean, how many grams of carb could be in one sucking sweet? And if you suck nonstop for 3 hours, you're still going to be like in the grams, you know?
Mm.
When in actual fact,
have a tired mouth.
I mean, there's actually been some quite good correspondence on patron Jan Geselaars emailed me with a bunch of questions, most of which I don't know the answer to. We've had some other like really good stuff on Instagram. Ronan McLaughlin got in touch, said he enjoyed it. He works for Escape Collective now, and they do some podcasts, one of which is now called The Performance Project. I think it's, let me not misquote that. Anyway, Ronan McLaughlin is the Everesting world record holder.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And we'll get him on the show because he's ace, and he does
definitely
this.
Definitely got to talk to him.
He does this. Are you thinking of Everesting?
I've been thinking about Everesting for a long time, but whether I actually do it or not. For those of you who don't know what Everesting is, and for new to the, it's a cycling challenge, which means that you ride up a hill so many times that you basically collect as many meters in height, in other words, to reach the top of the Everest, which is 8,848 meters. So the idea is that you try and do it in the minimum amount of time, with the minimum amount of, well, not necessarily distance, but time.
Yeah.
So in other words, he's reached that 8,848 meters in the minimum amount of time.
Yes. And so he's the world record holder in that. And he said to me,
I've got to chat to him.
He sent me, and so I was in touch with him. He said, because for me, the most interesting thing still is like, you got Inigo San Milan saying, athletes innovate ahead of the science. But in the meanwhile, we discovered last week papers from 2004, 2008, yet it hadn't reached the pro peloton. So which is it? Is it science was late or the athletes late to adopting? Can't be both.
No.
So it's a funny thing. Anyway, he mailed in touch with that and he said, for all the chat in the context now of Everesting, All the chat of roads and bike weights and tailwinds, it was fueling that was the opportunity for Everesting. It's as much an eating competition as a climbing challenge. I hit 140 grams an hour for 7 hours.
Yeah, we know that the previous level was 60 grams per hour.
Yeah, that's what they used to say.
They're pushing them to 90, 100. So 140
is... Yeah, that's what he said. 140 for 7 hours. So that's like over a kilogram, almost a kilogram and a half. No, wait, how's my maths? No, it's almost a kilogram. It's a kilogram of carbs, basically. If you do 170 in 7 hours, it's just under a kilogram of carbohydrates.
Wow.
Now, how many sweets in a kilogram?
Yeah.
You see, it's not conceivable that you're supplying energy that way.
So when we talk to him, we've got to ask him, how did he manage to consume that amount of carbohydrates and not get sick?
Right, because now that I've had my rubber arm twisted to ride this DC race, that's 200 Ks.
I'm responsible.
And I know it's going to be 8-9 hours for us. You know, we're going to have a nice day out with the group. I say, okay, I'm going to have to start practicing my fueling. And so on Monday, Tuesday, I went and did 90 K. I said, I'm going to try and go for 60 grams an hour. I was so sick.
Really? Yeah. At 60 grams an hour?
Yeah, because I'm so unused to, because normally we don't fuel.
No, we don't.
Because we know there's a coffee stop every hour. That's how we ride. So if you're hungry, you just stop at the first coffee shop, not the third one. You know what I mean? Like, it's never a problem. Or you stop at the cafe for a Coke. So I say I'm going to take some jelly babies and some water and so on. I'm going to just force myself. By the time I got off the bike, I felt like I was having stomach cramps.
Mm.
My mouth felt like I'd been at the dentist.
That's amazing.
So it takes a lot of practice to get used to it.
Because we talked a bit about that, getting the gut used to that.
Yeah, so that's what I'm trying to do now. Yeah. So I'll do that on Sunday when we do our long ride as well. It's just trying to overfeed, see if I can hit 80 grams an hour. Mm. But 140, like Ronan, wow.
It's incredible.
So the podcast is called The Performance Process, by the way. Okay. Mm. And it's one of those that's available to subscribers of Escape Collective. But I highly, they did a great show this week on aero testing, how you can practically, without getting into a wind tunnel, how do you know what's more aero on your bike and your setup and your equipment. Mm. So anyway, I'd love to get him on the show. It's been a bucket list guest for a while.
Definitely.
But more to the point, you just cannot suck enough sweets to literally fuel. I think what you are doing is you're probably central nervous system driving it. Ben got in touch on Patreon and he linked to a podcast, which I'll also include in the show notes. And Tim Noakes talks about carbs as a central nervous system stimulant.
Mm.
Now, Tim's got, I think, some questionable views on carbs. Because we know carbs are not just a central nervous system stimulant. They are literally fuel at the level of the muscle also.
Mm.
And if it was possible to get away without them, people would have by now. But I do think there is a central nervous system component to carbohydrates. And that's probably what the mouth rinsing method is doing.
Yeah, well, thanks, Simon. It was an interesting discussion we had even before we did this podcast on our WhatsApp group and just chatting about that. So thank you for sharing that information. Just to look back at some other news, the marathon world record basically shattered, if you can call it that. Calvin Kiptum in the Chicago Marathon running 2 hours and 35 seconds and beating Kipchoge's record by 34 seconds. That's what he ran in the 2022 Berlin Marathon. So, I mean, this was... I hate to say this, I didn't watch it live, and I struggled to watch the New York Marathon, which happened a couple of days ago live, because it's kind of becoming a bit of a procession, these records, and they're becoming so frequent now that they've kind of lost their gloss. I mean, there's huge celebration. The saddest thing, and I'm digressing slightly about the Chicago thing, is when Calvin Kiptum came across the line, it was almost an empty finish line. There was hardly anybody there, and there was just a couple of his sort of support teams that support him, whereas in Berlin, you have crowds lining the last bit of section after the Brandenburg Gate. In Chicago, there's virtually nobody there at the finish. Yeah. But in saying all that, it was a remarkable performance, and I've got a book that sits in my cupboard in my bookshelf which has got this, it's called 159, and I can't remember who wrote it now, and I got it about 3 or 4 years ago.
Caesar, right?
I think it was. And it talks about the likelihood of a sub-2-hour marathon and how unlikely it was, and we talked about this a few years ago. It is now looking that without all the, I'm not talking about Kipchoge's manufactured sub-2, does it look likely we're going to see a sub-2 legitimately in a race now?
Yeah, it does actually. I mean, 35 seconds,
yeah,
that's if he does okay. Hard to do the same thing again, but if he does it again, he'd run 1 second out, right? Because he was 34 seconds off.
He was 35. So his official time was...
He took
34. 2 hours and 35, yeah. So he needs to take... He took 34 seconds off the record.
So you've got to do the same thing again. Mm. Chicago has never been thought of as fast as Berlin, but clearly
Yeah, we've seen men, the right women's world records. Yeah.
And the women's world record was also Chicago. Remember when Costco did it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you got to think, like, it's funny. Someone sent me an article that I wrote in, like, 2009 on a website back then. And it was funny, like, A, reading it and seeing how poorly written it was. You know, it's like when you look at, like, a kid's, your childhood stuff and you think, did I actually write this? But I remember saying then, like, it would be 30, 40 years before we could even think about it. And here we are within 15.
It's extraordinary.
And I do think that's, we know why that is. Yeah. Well, we know if it's the shoes. Yeah. But it's interesting to think, like, okay, men and women now, we've got world record holders who've broken that world record in their third marathon without much pedigree before them.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, the woman's one was the same, eh? Like, it's there for him. Yeah, like, it's he's that guy. Yeah exactly. Yeah. Kipton, similar. So there's obviously, like, a lot of...
Kipton did the fastest ever debut in the 2022 Valencia, did a 2:01:53, which is, in relatively speaking, much slower.
And then what he did in... We said he'd be the next world record holder after London. Because he broke 60 in the second half in London.
That's right,
which is twisty, and it's sometimes a little bit windy, and it's not the fastest second half. And
he did 2:01:25 in London.
And that was with a sub-60 second half. So that's the guy.
Second fastest marathon ever at that time. Mm. Yeah.
And now he's done a 59:47 second half here.
Mm.
So it's quite clear, like... But then I think, well, who other than him, who would it be? It's like, it's not...
Well, he's definitely the favorite to do it, isn't he?
For sure.
Especially if you look at his trajectory.
By a lot. Mm. On the women's side, it's different, because I think there's five or six women who are all... Okay, Seth, that might be one level above everyone else. We'll see in time. But yeah, that's the new... It's new standard. The sport's recalibrated. That's as simple as that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting, and I've got some of the splits here, and this is what I find quite fascinating, is that... At the 5K mark, he went through 5Ks in 14:26, and Kipchoge, when he did his record, was 14:14. So he was way off at the 5K mark. He's slower at 10Ks. He's slower at 15Ks, exactly. He's slower at 20Ks by quite a distance. So 20Ks, the 15 to 20Ks, he does 14:30 compared to 14:12. But then he picks it up. From 25 kilometers, he's basically square with Kipchoge. At 30 kilometers, he's basically square. At 35 kilometers, he does 13:51 between 30 and 35 kilometers compared to 14:30 for Kipchoge. Then at 35 to 40 kilometers, he does 14:01. Yeah. So he runs a really fast split there compared to 14:43 for Kipchoge. And then the last sort of 2.195 kilometers, he runs a 6:12 compared to Kipchoge 6:16. So between 30 and 40 kilometers, that's when he makes up all of his time. And he's literally, if you look at it,
comfortably under 28 minutes. Eh? It's 27:50 for 10K.
Yeah. But that negative split, if you looked at the start of that race, you would have thought, well, there's no way he's going to beat his time based on his starting split because he's way behind at 21Ks. But actually, at 20Ks, he's run 57:39 compared to Kipchoge's 56:45. So it's a minute, which is a fair amount at that level.
Yeah, it's but he makes 350 it up. Meters. Eh? Yeah. Like, it's a lot.
He makes it up in the second half. It's a way to do it.
You know, and Kipchoge, I think, is an even split marathon.
Yes.
But Kipton's just running this big negative split. And it suggests, like, if he runs Paris in the Olympics next year, he'll be hard to beat because...
Would he run Paris, though? And he can make so much money at the big city marathons. If I was Kipton, I wouldn't
touch the Olympics. He's going to Rotterdam in April.
Is he?
Which is interesting in itself, because who goes to Rotterdam? Apparently his agent is the director there. So he's not going to London or Boston or any of the big city. Well, I suppose Rotterdam is a big city marathon. Let's not do it a disservice, but it's not one of the prestige ones, right? So that's interesting in itself. He'll go Rotterdam, and then will he go Berlin to try and break 2 hours, or will he go to? I'm sure the Kenyans would want him in the Olympic marathon team.
Yeah, but I mean, we've talked a bit about the fact that those Olympics World Championships are. And also you're not going to run a fast time. And he's got the potential. Why waste an Olympic Games in hot conditions when you can potentially earn a huge payday and running a sub-2?
Yeah, unless your sponsor says, we'll pay you as much to win the Olympics as we would to win Berlin.
Yeah.
But I can't see that. It'll be interesting because... Like, they're not exactly spoiled for choice in Kenya, but he is now so far and away the best guy.
Yeah.
Like, it's clear.
I mean, he is the new Kipchoge.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. So, yeah. I mean, they'll take Kipchoge to Paris for sure. He's already, I think, stated that he wants to.
Oh, he's an old man now, isn't he? 38 be next year, I think.
Yeah, and that's by birth registration. He might be even older. Who knows? Yeah. But yeah, it's Rotterdam is okay, but I mean, if you don't get perfect conditions, you're not breaking 2 hours.
Yeah.
You're not breaking the world record. And then if he did go to Paris, next year would be out. So when are we going to see a sub 2? 25, 26 maybe? If it's not Kiptum, who else? I mean, who's the next guy? Like, who knows? I mean, Valencia's coming up soon. Maybe we'll see a sub 201 there.
Yeah, because Valencia is an extremely fast course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, and you just the marathon now is just not the same.
Yeah.
Like, I've not even slightly surprised when a guy comes out and runs 201, 202, and I've never heard of him.
Yeah. because there's a lot of them.
Yeah, exactly. Same thing on the women's side, like 214s, 215s, debuts. Okay, cool. You know, remember 215, Paula Radcliffe, untouchable.
Yeah.
For a long time. Yeah. So, yeah, it's just a different, it's just been recalibrated now.
Yeah.
You missed a good race in New York, though, on the women's side. I'll tell you that.
I'm sad about that. Yeah, tell me a bit about it.
Well, it was slow because there was no incentive for them to run fast because you know that the park, Central Park, is going to slow the race down. So you're not going to see 214, 215. So they say, well, what's the difference between 219 and 224? Nothing really. So then it becomes tactical and then it's exciting.
Mm.
And so you had Obiri against Gide, which I think must be the most contrasting style athletes that you could possibly imagine in the last 400 meters. Like, Gide is just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And Obiri, let's say, is not, but is unbelievably effective. In fact, one of our patrons is Jay Grunke, who runs the Balanced Runner, and she posts videos on running form. And so you can find a video she's done on Helen Obiri and talks about how she uses her arms and so on. I mean, Obiri looked like she's going to run herself off her feet.
She's very gangly.
Yeah. And yeah, but anyway, so she outkicks Gide in the last sort of 400 meters up a hill to win that in Central Park. It was exciting. The men's race was super boring. It was fast, but it wasn't really anything to watch.
Tola winning that one, yeah.
As they came over the bridge into Manhattan, he went away with another Ethiopian. And
course record, though, wasn't it, the men's race?
Yeah, and that was the last big city marathon record. And it was the oldest. Now it's obviously the newest, sub 205 in New York, which is really good. So, like, I mean, but as a race spectacle, it was a great performance, but as a race spectacle, nothing to get too excited. It's not memorable. Whereas the women's race, I think, was actually very good. You know, last year's winner was third. Also, they were all together with like 1K to go. So it was pretty good.
Yeah. I mean,
the coverage was rubbish, though. Oh, my goodness. The women's race. So a couple of things. Because the women were so slow and the men were so fast, the men nearly caught the women, which would have been chaos. Yes. Like, because then they wouldn't know what to do.
Yeah.
As it was, with the women at like 800 meters to go, they cut to the men's race. Couldn't believe it. What are you doing? Like, you got three women and you could see it's shifting and it's building. And then they cut to the men's race where the one bloke's 2 minutes ahead of second place.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as if TV coverage is given to people who don't know what the sport involves.
I know. I do find American coverage of marathons quite poor generally. I think some of the commentating is also quite terrible.
I mean, the women's race was so good. And then we leave it to watch one guy running solo. It was awful. Anyway, luckily they got back to it by the time they hit the last.
Because I think the most amazing thing is that, and I say this coming from a media perspective, is that how a sport is presented on television is so critical to whether it's basically for its to support base, but also to its future popularity, and also whether it brings people into the sport. And we look at, for example, things like cycling at the moment, who have done a huge amount in terms of commentary. There's a huge focus on commentary. There's a lot of information that they get through the bikes that show you what's happening on the course. But it's always like marathon running has kind of stagnated a bit in that you don't have that excitement. And it's almost a sport when you watch it that's designed for the Puritan. You know, it's the guy that the it's not designed for the masses to understand the sport. And I think that's kind of sad because in a way it doesn't engender the same level of interest that you would, or the same spectacle as you get with many other sports.
So what would you do then? If you had three innovations that you could introduce to London and New York, Berlin, Boston next year?
I think you have to have real time. I think things like real time speed is important. They do have some of that, but they don't show it enough. They need to have
track and field tried that. Eh? Yeah, like sometimes gimmickly, like you watch a 1500 meter race and they show you the gap between two runners. You're like, I don't really need that. I can see that the one guy's a meter behind the other one. Stupid, but like I get your point.
Yeah, and yeah. When he accelerates, you must want to be able to see that somehow and say, right, there's an acceleration going here. And I think the level of the commentating, it's almost seems to some extent, and I think the Boston Marathon is a prime example, it almost feels like the character from The Simpsons, Ned Flanders, is always the it's his voice that almost, I don't know who the commentator is, but it sounds like him. You know, and I'm not, I mean, I've commentated on television and I've commentated on many different events, and I know it's very unfair to criticize commentators because they each have their own mix to it. But there is a certain level of excitement and commentary makes a huge difference to the excitement of the sport. And many of sports, Formula One, you know, with people like Murray Walker.
That might be the gold standard, actually.
Yeah, I mean,
and Murray Walker was probably like a museum piece. In a sport that evolved, like, but now the package, not just commentary actually, but the package around Formula One is so good.
It's excellent. But it's still Murray Walker was the one who kind of established, and same thing with Phil Liggett in cycling. As much as there are criticisms of him, he was the one who established the popularity of the sport because of his ability as a commentator.
Like, what you need is a guy who's insightful but exciting to listen to, and then you need a technical guy. Eh?
Yeah,
like that's exactly that partnership what you should have. Is the
You need a commentator and an expert.
Yeah. So like in New York, for instance, Galen Rupp was their on-course expert.
Yes.
And the bits that I heard, because I struggled for a feed, I was in London, he was actually quite good because he gave insight that you wouldn't otherwise hear. And then I'm starting to think to myself, like, actually what I want, what I'm complimentary of is more technical stuff. But what you just said is that it's almost pitching it at the purest and it's not catering to the lower guy. So what's the sweet spot between actually, because you know what gets me, like, I know exactly which commentator you're talking about is in Boston. He'll say, these men are so fast, and then he'll tell you go down to your club and run 100 meters in this time, that's how fast they are. I hate when they do that.
He's
it's almost like dumbing it down.
Yeah.
And when I watch good coverage of like NFL, they don't dumb it down, they actually pitch it in a way that's quite challenging to watch, and I like that. So should marathon running try and reduce itself to the park runner who runs twice a week, or should it actually embrace its specialist technical content? You know what I mean?
Yeah, but there's a balance between those two things. You know, and when I think about when I watch the Chicago Marathon and watching a world record happening in front of no crowd, that's the fault of the organizers. They need to create a spectacle. Berlin does it brilliantly. London does it brilliantly. New York does it brilliantly. But Chicago does it terribly. It's sad to see a world record happening and nobody's there to see it except people watching on television. It just makes it look like some sort of local race. All of those things make the sport the spectacle it is. And I think we've talked a lot about the fact that in this podcast that at some stage records are going to plateau. It must do at some stage.
Yeah.
Therefore, the competition, the race, the women's race in New York should be the standard. We want to watch a race that competes. Therefore, should we have pace setters, for instance, in the events? I still don't believe we should.
And again, New York doesn't.
Yes.
And it makes for great
racing. It makes
for
a great race. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, anyway. Do you want fast times or great racing? I take great racing every time.
Yeah, because I couldn't visually, if there was no clock on the screen and if they didn't time the race, I wouldn't be able to tell you the difference between a 2:08 and a 2:02.
Exactly.
But I would definitely tell you the difference between five people in the last mile and one guy running by himself. And I
that's
know which one I choose to watch.
That's why championship racing at World Championships and Olympic Games is so good, because on the track, because it's there's no pace setters.
And it creates a jeopardy that doesn't exist in a paced race. Like Ingebrigtsen is never losing a paced race.
Yes.
But he may never win a 1500 unpaced.
Yeah.
That's the great storyline. That's the great storyline ahead of the Paris Olympic Games, right? Is Ingebrigtsen going to figure out a gold 1500?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's interesting because the same conversation came up all the time during the Rugby World Cup is, does rugby embrace its technicalities or does it try and appeal to the casual fan? And you get two camps. They say, the final, for instance. So a lot of criticism of the final, like, and most of it coming out of New Zealand, no wonder why, but saying like it's anti-rugby, this is not how the sport wants to look on its biggest stage. But meanwhile, the people who really love the sport are saying this was one of the great finals, loved it, absolutely enthralling, because they understand what they're watching. And so what does the sport do? Does it want to penetrate like new markets, which requires like sacrificing some of its technicality and authenticity, or does it want to appeal to its loyal customer base? And I'm in the latter camp, I think.
Yeah,
you know, I would rather... You know, the tension that exists, and we mentioned it last week, is you've got guys on Twitter who do such good work, like doing technical analysis and coverage and so on. And then you've got the mainstream media, and they sort of pander to the masses. So there's like a tension where, yeah, and it's interesting, like cycling's similar, I think. I mean, if I watch cycling with like Leanne, she doesn't understand why there's a group of guys five minutes up the road.
Mm.
And I say, no, they're going to get caught. Then the very next day, 5 minutes up the road, this brake's going to go away. They're going to succeed. Oh, how do you know? What's the difference? No, it's just the subtle context.
Yeah, yeah.
Love that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But like to the casual fan, that's like a mystery.
Yeah.
So what should cycling do? Should it? You know what I mean?
It appeals to its fan base. It's true.
Yeah.
But then a lot of people who don't watch cycling, who are not necessarily cycling fans, watch it because they like the scenery. And I often get that as well.
My mum's like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a Tour de France time. Amazing. It's a 3-week tour package.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He doesn't care about who's gone in the break. He just wants to see the castles.
Exactly. My dad's the same. He says, I don't like it when they do like laps.
Mm.
So because then I see the same thing over and over. I say I love it when they do laps because I learn the pattern and I know when the attack's going to come. Like in Glasgow at World Champs, I say, no, I know where the big hill is. I know where Van der Poel and Van Aert and anyway, labouring the point now a little bit. So
final news story, I think, of the day, and this is kind of highlighted the doping passport, which has been around for a number of years now, and this is the story of the Kazakhstan former Kenyan athlete Nora Geruto, who was cleared of doping charges this week, and it's quite a complicated one because she's obviously the former world 3000 meter steeple champion. She won that title in Eugene in 2022.
So big name.
She's a big name. But she was eventually cleared, and it is complicated because it was a blood doping. That's kind of from what I've read. It's a blood doping test or not non-test or I don't know.
So it's called an ADRV, anti-doping rule violation.
Right, there we go.
Call it a positive test.
Yes.
But it's not a positive test because we found a banned substance in your body. It's a positive test because we found evidence of manipulation of your body by doping methods.
Mm.
Makes a difference, right?
As evidenced by your passport.
Yeah, as in, it's not that we found testosterone or EPO or anything in your urine or blood. It's that we found irregularities in your blood profile so large and unexplainable that we in this instance being the athletics integrity unit, believe that we had enough to ban you as a doper. On appeal, that's been overturned. So in a way, it's quite a big story because it's a blow to the biological passport, and it's a blow to the AIU. It's not their first loss in a while. I mean, they lost the Toby Amusan appeal, you know, the Nigerian hurdler, back at just before Budapest Worlds this year. So that's a couple of cases now that they've lost on appeal. So they've probably got to look at the process a little bit there and so on. But this one's pretty interesting because the biological passport doesn't often get tested like this, and it's failed this test. That's reality. I mean, like, we can be blunt about it. The biological passport was used to issue an anti-doping rule violation, and it's been overturned.
But there are some extenuating circumstances that it's difficult to say that it's a precedent, isn't it? Because it's
weirdness. Like, you know, the biological passport was introduced in 2009.
Mm.
And do we want to go into the premise of it?
The listeners that are not sure what a biological passport is, let's just explain it briefly.
So the challenge for anti-doping and the problem that needed to be solved by the passport is that anti-doping was reliant on detecting a substance in the body. And by the time the athlete competes, the substance has left the body, but its benefits are still there. So in other words, I was using a drug for a certain period. I stopped using it in order to be clean. I'm still a doper, but at the time I was tested, I looked like a clean athlete. That's a challenge, right? So, and the best analogy I've ever heard is if you imagine conceptually like a long dark tunnel, and there's a car traveling through this tunnel at 120 km/h, anti-doping is trying to shine a light on that car at the exact moment that it comes past it.
Yeah.
Very difficult. So unless you literally have a light every second along that journey, you're probably missing that car.
It epitomizes the doping struggle, doesn't it?
Exactly. So what the biological passport was intended to do was to measure the physiological change in response to doping, not the presence of the drug. And initially the thought was, let's do this for all drugs. But for various reasons, it's much more challenging with steroid hormones like testosterone, growth hormone, insulin-like growth factor. But where it was feasible was blood manipulation. So when an athlete is doping with EPO or taking blood out, putting blood back in, they're trying to boost the oxygen carrying capacity of the blood. Those actions, EPO use, withdrawal, infusion, change the composition of the blood in a logical and predictable way. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
I take blood out, my red blood cell count goes down. That's obvious. It's exactly what I've done. I've removed. It's like emptying your cupboard of all the tins of tuna. There's less tuna in the cupboard, obviously.
Well, that's an interesting point. So if you take, if you're blood doping, in other words, at high altitude, you take your blood out of your body, you're saying it's certainly the percentage of blood, of plasma versus red blood cell stays the same in the body, even if you remove some.
It corrects itself, but in the immediate aftermath of giving, like if you take 500 mils of whole blood out, mm-hmm. you're going to feel it, because now all of a sudden, remember, your red blood cells are the oxygen carriers. So effectively, they are transporters of oxygen. And if you remove enough blood, you have reduced the transport capacity.
Volume.
Forget tuna in a cupboard. I don't know where that analogy came from. Let's try to go with...
Normally, your analogies are quite good.
Yeah, the tuna in a cupboard. I don't know what I was thinking there. Let's talk about cars on the road.
Yeah.
Taxis. So like, okay, let's take 10% of the taxis off the road. We can no longer transport people.
Mm.
And that's the situation in the blood. I remove blood, hemoglobin levels drop, my hematocrit, which is the percentage of the blood occupied by cells, is down. So in the immediate window after withdrawal, that's the change I'd see. A couple of days after that, my body's responding to the blood loss by making new blood, because that's what it does. It's clever. And so now we measure something different. We see more young blood cells because we're seeing a process of adaptation to blood removal. Makes sense?
Yeah.
EPO, same thing. It's a hormone that drives blood cell formation. So if I used EPO on a Monday, by Thursday, Friday, I'm seeing an increase in new blood cell formation. By the following week, I'm seeing more red blood cells. So there are predictable changes in a blood composition and makeup that reveal, and this is the theory, whether or not you've blood doped, removed blood, infused blood, used EPO. Makes sense, right?
Which means you have to have done a certain amount of tests to create a baseline.
Because the degree to which those things vary from day to day, from week to week, from month to month, differs from you to me.
Yeah.
So what the biological passport premise was is that if we test longitudinally over time and we establish a certain pattern, we can look for variations in that pattern where all of a sudden a drop in red blood cells might indicate one thing. An increase in reticulocytes, which is young, immature blood red blood cells, indicates a different thing. And so the change and the pattern of that change, the timing and the size of that change, are the indicators of blood doping. And that was the premise of the passport.
Mm-hmm.
Great concept, because all of a sudden meant that we no longer had to find EPO in your urine or blood. We no longer had to catch you taking your blood out. We could actually just measure the effect of that change. The problem is that the risk of a false positive is high enough that you have to be quite conservative about acting on that data. Make sense? Because there is such a thing as natural variation.
Mm.
I go to altitude for a camp and my red blood cell count will go up. I come down from altitude, my red blood cell formation will come down. And so there is natural variation caused by dehydration, hard training. There's a whole bunch of different things that affect it. So the upper and lower limits beyond which change becomes unusual have to be necessarily wide. Makes sense?
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're going to start saying blood doping. And actually, all it is altitude camp.
Yeah.
And so that's the problem for the passport. And that's incidentally, the reason the steroid passport has been harder to get off the ground is because that volatility is even greater there. For the blood stuff, at least it's feasible there. And they only introduced the steroid passport this year for the first time. So it's a challenge. When the passport was first introduced, one of the first challenges it faced was an Italian cyclist called Franco Pellizzotti. And his argument was that his unusual blood readings were the result of blood loss caused by a stomach ulcer. Because what he was saying, remember, the theory is if I take blood out because I'm going to be naughty with it and store it up and use it in a few months' time, there's a measurable change to my blood in the immediate aftermath of that withdrawal. He's saying the same thing happened to him because of an ulcer. And so he challenged the passports on that basis and lost. And it was a big moment. I remember talking to guys, York Ola Schumacher, who'd been involved in the development of the passport. He says it was a real significant victory because it was the first time that the biological passport had been tested in a legal setting and it passed that test. Experts discussed and assessed and so on, and they decided that an ulcer couldn't be the reason for the changes. It had to have been removal of blood. Geruto, one of her defenses was a stomach ulcer,
yeah.
And she's won it. So that's a long way to answer your question about precedent, is I don't know. Because the sporting legal system isn't a precedent-based system. They evaluate every case as though it's the first.
Mm.
But it is a significant moment. I think it's significant because Geruto was able to convince them of two things. One is that her sudden loss of red blood cells in March 2020 was the consequence of a peptic ulcer.
Mm.
And later on, she was able to convince them that a sudden increase in red blood cells was the result of a medical condition.
So, I mean, there must be some evidence that a peptic ulcer has an effect on red blood cells. I mean, there must be some scientific evidence that would prove that. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken it seriously.
And I'm nobody's idea of a gastroenterologist, but in the decision, and I'll post a link to this, at Geruto's appeal, because now what happens, remember, the AIU says you're guilty of a rule violation.
Mm-hmm.
She then has the right to appeal, and that's what this came out earlier this
week.
She
appeals with the disciplinary tribunal.
Yeah.
And that's not part of the AIU. That's just a separate
necessary
body.
It's a necessary legal vehicle that any athlete has the right to appeal. So it's an independent tribunal that then she goes to with her legal team and her experts, and they have a gastroenterologist and they have a blood hematologist because they're going to... You see, then the AIU's got their gastroenterologist and hematologist, and they have a debate, basically. That's how it works. It's a tribunal, and they have a debate, and then the panelists, three of them, assess this and say, who's more credible, who do we believe, and then they make their decision.
Right.
And so, so she has a hematologist, and the AIU has a hematologist, and so, for instance, point 54, the athlete's anemia in 2021 and 2020 and 21 was consistent with blood loss from gastrointestinal bleeding from a peptic ulcer disease. He relied on her. She said she vomited and had blood in her diarrhea. So she was claiming she lost blood. Now, the reason this matters, just to take one step back, is, and in the document, you'll see a collection of samples going all the way back to 2016 for her, for Nora Geruto.
Mm-hmm.
The samples in question were in March 2020, and her hemoglobin level, which up to that point was always in the high 14s, low 15s. I'm looking here, 15.3, 15.1, 15.6, 15.1, 14.4, 15, 12.8, 13.6. That's a large drop in hemoglobin. With it, reticulocytes, which is young blood cells, goes from 1.1, 0.7, 1.5, 1.1, 4.3, 3.7. So the pattern is loss of red blood cells, formation of new blood cells. So that, in the AIU's interpretation, has to have meant removal of blood and the response to make new blood, blood withdrawal.
Right.
Her explanation, loss of blood because of a peptic ulcer, vomiting blood, diarrhea with blood in it. That's point one of that debate. Okay.
Okay.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not convinced.
No, it makes total sense, but it just seems unlikely. Not that I know enough about peptic ulcers.
Neither do I. So, and unfortunately, like the CAS decision runs into hundreds, hundreds of pages, and they really explain this. They don't really give you, in this decision, like a good insight into what the experts debated.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like left a little bit unsure. But what's really interesting about this is that, and this is, if you were like uncertain before, wait till you hear this one. So they talk about the experts and how they debate. And the AIU's expert says it's not possible to lose enough blood in diarrhea and vomiting to account for these changes.
That's exactly my question.
Her experts say, well, it is. Okay, so it's a he said, she said thing.
Right.
But they never even rule on it because what they say is, point 51, in our judgment, this simply does not work for the AIU to argue this. Assume for a moment that the athlete did withdraw blood with a view to subsequent administration of blood in breach of M1, which is a protocol. The withdrawal cannot of itself constitute an attempt to administer blood any more than the purchase of a gun for a nefarious purpose can constitute attempted murder. That's what they say in the it's unbelievable.
Okay. Yeah.
You know what they're saying? So they're saying she might have withdrawn blood, but that's not She's not guilty of anything.
Not guilty of anything by withdrawing blood, yes.
Exactly. And yeah. So they when they refer to M1 here, it's pretty interesting because I looked up what this means. M1 is a prohibited method in the WADA code, and it literally says the administration or reintroduction of any quantity of autologous, homologous, or heterologous blood or red blood cell products. So in other words, putting it in is illegal. Yeah. But withdrawing it is not.
Yes.
And so even if she'd taken it out, until you could prove that she intended and did put it back in, there's no crime.
Yes.
There's no offense, right?
And that those blood values don't suggest she put it back in.
Not at that time.
Yes.
But we'll get to
okay,
that.
Okay, all right.
What's interesting is that point three under M1 says the following are prohibited. Any form of intravascular manipulation of the blood or blood components by physical or chemical means. I'm not sure why the AIU didn't argue that could apply to the withdrawal of blood.
Mm.
Because when I withdraw blood, I am manipulating the blood by physical means.
Yes.
Like, so clearly it's not. And in fact, I'm obviously like legally not confident enough to say this, but in the document, the AIU itself admit that the withdrawal of blood is not in and of itself an offense.
So if you withdraw blood, does it, and you talked about the young blood cells, does that not, in other words, there's no advantage to withdrawing blood? You talked about the fact that it generates young blood cells. Are they better than mature blood cells in that respect?
No,
because there isn't a benefit.
Because there's a life cycle of blood cells anyway. Yeah. So when it's like if those cars, you know, those cars are going to like depreciate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And their tires are going to go bald and their engines will fail. Then they just get replaced by new taxis. Yeah. And so the body.
So the only advantage is putting in the good blood
correct.
When you
and
need
that,
it.
That was the practice from the 1970s. The practice was take it out. Put it back in.
Yeah. Take it out at altitude, put it back in.
Not even at altitude, anytime.
Really?
You don't need, because there's red blood cells are red blood cells. So what you're going to get when you put it back in is that sudden boost, more cars on the road, as it were.
So it's not necessarily dependent on taking it at high altitude
higher
component.
No, you just want red blood cells that are available to take.
So you're just like, increasing volume.
At that immediate increase in volume.
Right.
And that's the method. So, and the reason you do it with your own blood is because it overcomes certain risks. You know, Tyler Hamilton's book talks about how they used to use anyone's blood.
Yeah.
As long as it was the right type. And then you can get all sorts. And Hamilton speaks in the book about guys like having serious medical emergencies.
Yes.
So you take it out, you store it for a period, and then you reinfuse it. And that's what they're doing. But it's the reinfusion that's obviously the problem. It's like, it's interesting that no athlete has ever said, I'm a blood donor.
Mm.
Like to try and explain it. Because that could do it. That's enough. Maybe not. You know, I donated a lot of blood because family emergency or something. But then you've got to prove medical records.
You see,
that's the thing. Yeah. And did she prove peptic ulcer? Yeah. Turns out she didn't need to because the withdrawal cannot of itself constitute an attempt to administer blood any more than the purchase of a gun.
Yeah.
So they almost say, oh, maybe it was an ulcer, maybe it was withdrawal. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Then the second part of the decision concerns two samples that were taken in September of 2020. So they were.
So that is what, 6 months after?
Yeah. And this is where I really wish this decision gave us a little bit more, because these experts would have produced like documents, right? Mm. That are submitted like with their expert interpretation of the results and exactly what's happened. But basically, in September of that year, she gives a couple of samples where the hematocrit levels are up and the reticulocyte levels are considerably higher as well. And so they talk about sample 17 to 19, September, three samples collected in September 2020. The AIU are saying that this shows that she must have used EPO at different doses, because what's happened is she's had an increase in the reticulocyte fraction, red blood cell width, and so forth. I'll give you the exact numbers of these things now. So all of a sudden, hematocrit, which remember, barring those two low ones, was 15, 14, high 14s, goes to 16.1, 17.1, 16.1. So how do you get the spike in red blood cells? How do you get an increase in reticulocyte fractions? AIU says must be EPO use.
Right.
Because you're getting a simultaneous increase in red blood cells and reticulocytes.
Right.
So you're driving blood cell formation.
Mm.
Make sense?
Yeah.
Her expert argues that it has to be the consequence of an illness. And the illness in question, and this takes us back to September 2020, is COVID.
Mm.
What's most interesting about this is that Jeruta
Jeruta, yeah.
doesn't herself say that she had COVID. She says she was sick. She says that she went to a hospital and they told her she had tuberculosis. So, like, we also had to, at this point, 62, we had to take into account the athlete's own evidence about her illness in August and September 2020. She was sufficiently unwell that she went to hospital. Her evidence was that she was told that she did not have COVID-19, but was told she had tuberculosis.
Right.
The panel has decided that her evidence, her blood sample, could be explained by COVID-19. That's the thing she was told she didn't have. I can't understand how they...
I mean, again, it begs the question whether COVID-19 suddenly sees an increase in red blood cells. What?
Apparently, like, so she's got an expert called Dr. Brandt's evidence. This is point 59. The combination of high percentage of reticulocytes, increased red cell width, and no corresponding increase in red percent are consistent with a COVID-19 infection, which causes stimulated, isolated erythropoiesis. So the theory is that COVID does drive red blood cell formation. I didn't know that until I read this, and I don't know any more about it than that statement.
Yeah.
Someone well,
obviously,
who studies
there obviously some study that proves that, yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Brandt, who's the athlete's witness, expert witness, put this to Prof. D'Onofrio, who's the AIU hematology guy, well-known actually in anti-doping world. He's one of the guys who does all the passport stuff. In an exchange between experts, Prof. D'Onofrio said he did not think the results could be related to a mild infection and were more consistent with EPO injection in small doses. World Athletics criticized Dr. Brandt's evidence because, notwithstanding his hematological experience, he has no experience of the biological passport, and D'Onofrio's evidence should be considered more reliable. World Athletics also criticized Dr. Brandt for having changed his position and a lack of reference to stress erythropoiesis in his first report. So when he first had to account for her unusual blood values, he didn't mention stress caused by illness, and only later did he add it in. And they're saying, well, now he's just fitting the facts. He's fitting the story, the story. So despite all this, though, in conclusion, we found the factual evidence somewhat unsatisfactory in relation to this period. The biological passport showed abnormal results consistent with relatively low dose of EPO, which would be an ADRV. We did not find resolution of this charge easy. We accept there was room for the view that Dr. Brand's conclusions were somewhat speculative. Now, you read that and you're like, okay, they're teeing up a rejection of the athlete's appeal. However, the majority of the panel is persuaded that having heard the experts and recognizing that all the experts were distinguished practitioners, the sample results might also be explained by a bout of COVID-19. The thing they told her she didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Not tuberculosis, COVID-19.
Well, they're then saying that her diagnosis was wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're saying that now, in 2023, we are going to say it was more likely COVID, even though at the time, in September 2020, they said it wasn't.
Maybe they said it was at a rural hospital or something
must
like that.
Be, must be. Like, and that's where actually want those doctors to talk about it. Like, so the process looks a bit shallow to me. On balance, we cannot say World Athletics have proved their case so that we are comfortably satisfied. While we recognize compelling arguments were made, there is sufficient doubt on the part of the case that it would be unfair to convict the athletes. Thus, point 66, we dismiss the charges. So, yeah, sure. it's a weird... Because the way the passport works is that there's a statistical flag of a sample, which is then seen by an expert.
Mm-hmm.
That expert says, okay, I can see why this is unusual, and I think it's likely doping. Then it goes to three independent assessors. So they've built all these checks and balances in to make sure that they don't inadvertently accuse someone of doping. Then what happens is they say, right, our account... And I attended a conference, a water conference in Rome. It's fascinating because they'd show like a passport... profile on the screen, and then say, right, now discuss among yourselves, small group exercise. And then these experts say, right, the timing, that increase, this decrease, that could be EPO, that could be withdrawal. And they have to create a storyline off the data.
Mm.
Athlete withdrew the blood on this date, they put it back in on this date, and then they give that to the athlete, and the athlete has to counter explain, say, no, this was a peptic ulcer, and then I was sick. And then it's a question of whose story is more plausible. And what this decision unfortunately does is it invites even withdrawal.
Yeah.
Like, okay, so she, and I guess I could see that maybe she did withdraw blood because a relative was sick. Yeah. I mean, okay, she could have said that.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
And she didn't disclose a peptic ulcer at the time of the sample. Like, there's things there to protect the athlete against this. You're like, if you have a blood sample taken, you should say, hey, you know what, I've actually got an ulcer. I've been vomiting blood for the last week.
Yeah, you think she'd offer
maybe
that.
Maybe disclose that at the time, not 3 years later when you're charged.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, it does sound a bit suspicious, that.
And then the idea that you'll say, oh, it could have been COVID, when the athlete herself has said, it, well, I didn't have COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost like where you sort of get nudged in the direction of an accused person. Mm. Just listen, I'll tell you what to say. Just get your story right here, please.
Yeah, so. I mean, so your first reaction when you saw that was, it's incredible that she's kind of been cleared here, because there's so much conflicting evidence. Well, I don't know whether it necessarily diminishes the value of the blood passport, because it's not like somebody can say, well, this happened to me exactly the same way, because every case is treated independently, and nobody's going to go there and say, I had peptic ulcer and then 6 months later I had COVID and therefore I'm giving you the same excuses she did.
I tell you what it might do though, is like, if you're the AIU, you might think a fourth time now, because the thing is, they don't just bring a case. They think once, they think twice, they put it through a third check, and then they bring the case.
That's not random,
yeah. Yeah, like it's actually quite onerous. They've got to have unanimous agreement between three independent people assessing it, that there's a plausible doping explanation for the numbers I'm seeing on the page. That's how they, and it's done that way to try and like shore up and reduce the risk of that false positive, this exact scenario.
Yeah,
they will now be a little shyer, I think, to bring a passport case. But and that might not be the worst thing, because the passport's very rarely responsible for catching athletes. Asbel Kiprop, I think, is a passport case. More often than not, well, no, actually, he's not a passport case. He was a EPO case who they target tested because of the passport. And that's the point I was trying to get to, and I've gotten to somewhat clumsily, is what the passport has, I think, been useful for is identifying unusual patterns that aren't quite strong enough to say doper, but are definitely strong enough to say something funny going on here. Let's test like crazy on this athlete. So then it becomes a tool to guide target testing.
Yeah, and I mean, so, we're trying to decide. I mean, we don't know what testing a lot is compared to testing minimal. As it sounds like she's been tested quite a lot.
Yeah, between the first of those suspicious samples and like 2022, there were 23 tests in like 2 years. Now, is that a lot? I would imagine that's quite high. That your Olympic champion guys are probably getting one a month, one every 2 months, batches around competitions and so on. But the passport is still going to be useful as a guide towards suspicion that then informs targeted testing. But as a standalone doping conviction tool, hasn't caught many, and now it's lost a case. So that's,
and now there's talk of the passport being able to use power values in cycling potentially. I mean, touched on steroid passport, how difficult that is to do. It could become advanced, but again, there are lots of questions, particularly on the power side.
And again, I'm going to put all this in the show notes for you, so you'll have it. The guy who did that was Mikel Zabala. Mikel Zabala, who's a physiologist out of Spain, a sports scientist and a professional cycling coach. And they've got a paper, which is not new, it's from March, called Anti-Doping 2.0. Is it time to add power data to the biological passport? The idea being similar to the passport itself is that the point of doping is to change the blood to enable the performance. And we used to measure the substance, now we measure the blood. Can we also measure the performance?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like if we have another piece of information. Where it gets tricky is that the performance is so variable, depending on time of year and so forth. So you'd have to really be like systematic and controlled in how you measure it, because what you measure from Jonas Vingegaard in March compared to June compared to October will be quite different, whereas the physiology won't be as different. Like, I think it'll be more consistent. So not a new concept. I remember going to the Tour de France conference. There's a scientific conference the week before the tour back in Leeds in 2014. A guy called James Hopka was presenting performance profiling as a potential anti-doping tool. And I do think it's useful. There's potential for it, right? Because donkeys don't become racehorses unless there's some suspicion.
Yeah.
You know, and there must be an explanation for it.
And we've seen that on the tour when you suddenly see a guy who's not normally a climber suddenly climbing with the best, and it makes you think, hang on a minute.
You see that in running. I mean, like, you see athletes who've never run sub 4 minute 1500s for women, nice thing, running 357s, 58s. Remember that London 2012, all those Turkish women? Like, they were all done for doping. There have been loads of cases like it. So So I do think the sudden emergence and sudden improvements, and I guess what they're saying here is that if you measured power output enough and you had some metric, but yeah, it's tough, eh? Because like athletes do improve.
Yeah.
And they do get worse. So,
variables are huge.
Whatever the noise and the normal variation is in the blood, imagine what it looks like for performance. Mm. And to try and relate two noisy things to one another could be quite tricky. But I think it's a, I think it's definitely a conversation worth having because I do think, look, you can have too much information, but I'd rather have more information and discard it than not know and be clueless.
And suddenly you see a whole bunch of cyclists, their power meters are broken.
Well, that's the other, that's always the thing they said is like, oh, you can't trust the power meter. It's like calibration wise and so on. Yeah. And that's true. Like, because if the margin created by doping was 3 or 4%, but the variation in power output accuracy was 5% because of calibration, it's useless. Eh? So speaking of, just out of interest, did you see Chris Froome said the other day that he discovered a problem in his bike setup since he joined with Israel Premier Tech, where his setup was, his saddle was a couple centimeters too low and his reach on the stem was like 3 centimeters different from what he's used to. And now he's changed it and he thinks he can perform again.
Right. Well, we'll have to see if he does that.
If you went in for a coffee break and I lowered your saddle by a centimeter,
How quickly
would you pick it up when we start riding again?
Well, maybe not pick it up because you wouldn't expect it. But I know that I'm talking cycling specifically, I'm very sensitive to saddle height and I can pick it up when it's dropped to centimeter.
And if I lengthened your stem by a few centimeters?
Maybe, I don't know.
It's inconceivable to me that you could be riding along and not realize that there were such big mistakes in your setup. I just saw it and I just had to laugh.
He has to justify the reason why he hasn't done well so far.
He hasn't stopped justifying.
Anyway, I'm a bit of a fan of Chris Froome. I think he's had a bit of a, I think at the end of his career should have ended a few years ago, but he's obviously got a contract he has to fulfill with Israel Premier Tech and has to keep him going somehow. He's got a very entertaining YouTube channel, actually, which I find quite fascinating and interesting to watch.
I saw a tweet by Benji Nazan, who's one half of that Lantern Rouge podcast, which is also a really good one. I'd like to get him on, actually. They were in London, there was a big cycling convention in London called, and I've forgotten the name of it now. But I should have gone, next time. But anyway, I tweeted something about that Froome story, and he says like something about from Batman, if you stick around long enough, you become the meme.
That's a great line. Anyway, thanks very much, Professor Ross Tucker, as usual. Some great news stories to focus on, and lots happening in the world of sport, of course. The Cricket World Cup, which is taking place in India at the moment. That's quite fascinating, and lots of semi-finals about to be happening there, so keep an eye on that. And of course the end of the year stuff is happening. I think the Formula One season has just finished as well, so we'll be able to wrap up hopefully in the next couple of months or a couple of weeks, actually, or kind of wrap up of the year. But keep an eye on the crickets, but for now it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.